Acts chapter 23, verse 12 is where we are at currently. But before we dive into that part, where have we been? Where has Paul been the last couple of days? Yeah, technically in jail. In what city? What location? He wants to get to Rome, but where is he at right now? He's in Jerusalem. And what's going to happen? Paul gets to Jerusalem. He finally gets there. He gives his report. You know, hey, Gentiles converting like crazy. Sweet. And they're like, hey, guess what? You know what? Jews here have been converting like crazy. Sweet. And then there's like, but there's a problem. What's the problem? Yeah, the Jews have been converting, Paul, are very zealous for the law. As a matter of fact, there's a rumor going around about you. It basically says you just disregard all the Old Testament as a whole. Mosaic law, who cares? Do what you want. And Paul's like, well, that's not what I'm saying. That doesn't matter what you're saying. It matters what people are thinking that you're saying. And so James and the elders in Jerusalem, they say, hey, this is what we think you should do. We want you, we have four guys that have been doing a Nazirite vow. They've come to the end of it. They needed to go through the purification rituals and even have pay for their vow. So we want you to be the one that kind of administers the closing of that vow in front of everyone so that everybody can see that you're not throwing away the Mosaic law, that you're actually keeping it. Paul says, that's fine. I'll do whatever I need to do just to make peace because I want them to actually hear what I'm saying. So they go and do it. And what happens? While Paul is there, what happens? Anybody remember? He's in the temple and all of a sudden, oh, it's been a week and a half. What? Yeah, yeah. Why? Brought a Gentile into the Jewish courts, right? As a matter of fact, what were the people that who were the people that noticed him? They were Jews from what region? Asia. From Asia, from the area of Ephesus, right? So they noticed him, and they noticed, I believe it was Trophimus. Was that his companion? Yes, they noticed Trophimus with him at some point, and they said he probably took him inside the temple. They assumed that he did. A riot breaks out. They start tearing Paul to shreds, and all of a sudden swoops in the Roman commander to bring peace. And as soon as he comes in, they all kind of stop beating Paul with, you know, his blood everywhere. And they're like, I don't know what happened. He fell down the stairs, you know. And the guy's like, hey, give it to me. We got to figure out what's going on. He arrests Paul, binds him at his hands and feet, just like what prophet said he would? Agabus, back in Acts chapter 21. So you see him bound, and Claudius Lysias, which we'll find that is his name today, the Roman commander, ends up saving him three separate times. Remember that. Three separate times from some sort of killing or some sort of beating. Because after this one, he ends up taking him, and he says, all right, you can speak to everyone. And then they start to riot and freak out because he says, God sent me to the Gentiles. So Claudius Lysias saves him again. And then he goes before the Sanhedrin, and Claudius Lysias has to save him again because of what issue that Paul throws out in the middle of the Sanhedrin? The resurrection. I'm on trial because I'm a Pharisee and I believe in the resurrection. The Pharisees are like, I don't have a problem with it. Sadducees are like, he's blasphemous. And they start fighting amongst each other. To the point where Claudius Lysias was afraid that Paul was going to be torn apart. So he pulls him back and then he's like, all right, I still don't know the answer. I'm going to beat this guy until he tells me. But what was the issue? Why doesn't he beat him? He's a Roman citizen. And all of a sudden, Claudius Lysias freaks out and is trying to figure out what he's going to do to save his own hide, save his own political career. And that's where we're at in verse 12. After all that occurs, I believe we're in verse 12, aren't we? Yeah, we are. Good. It's been a week and a half. Okay. The next morning, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves with an oath not to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. Whoa. Matter of fact, the word oath is not the traditional word for oath. It is not the word that you would see with a Nazirite vow or any of that type of oath. The word, now I'm going to say it in Greek, and I want you to see if you can hear what English word it sounds like. In Greek, this word is anathematizo. Anathematizo. What's it sound like? Anybody? Anathematizo. Close, kind of. Nah. Anybody know what this word means? In English? Anathema? Wow. Doesn't sound like any word we know, Shane. Okay. This word in English, it has the connotation of curses or bringing curses. Someone is cursed. They are anathema. As a matter of fact, what this word literally means in the Greek is they called curses down on themselves from God. More than an oath, it's much stronger than that. They're actually saying, may we be damned by God if we do not accomplish what we are vowing to accomplish. May our very salvation be on the line if we do not accomplish what we want to accomplish. And what do they want to accomplish? They want to kill Paul. So literally they have two things now that's driving their zeal. Their very salvation is on the line, according to their oath. Because if they don't accomplish it, they say, we want the curses of God to fall on us. You will try a little harder if that's at stake. And, kind of a different type of steak, but if you're not able to eat, then you're going to really want to get that figured out too, because you're used to fasting, but not for that long. Therefore, they take this, in a sense, a double oath, calling curses down on them salvifically as well as physiologically, and saying, until Paul is dead, these two will not be back in place. That kind of elevates their zeal to a frightening level, if I could understate what is actually occurring here. They're going to call curses down on themselves and refuse to eat until they had killed Paul. More than 40 men were involved in this plot. 40 men. Verse 14, they went to the chief priests and elders and said, we have taken an oath not to eat until we have killed Paul. Now then, you and the Sanhedrin petition the commander to bring him before you on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about this case. We are ready to kill him before he gets here. You see their plan. They're being more clandestine now. They're being more secretive. Because before, this public rioting was not working very well. Because all it was doing was the iron fist of Rome was coming in to bring back some sort of peace. They said, we got to be a little bit more sneaky. So why don't you just, here's the plan. You say that you want something here. This won't fall on your heads. This will fall on our heads. You say you just want some, we just want accurate information. We just want to make sure we're governing in the right way. And when he gets here, before he gets here, we'll kill him. Now notice what's ironic about this. Who do they go to? There's actually several ironies in this. But who do they go to? The chief priests, the Sanhedrins. Matter of fact, they are getting permission from the Jewish elite to persecute and even kill Paul. Does that sound familiar? Does that sound like Paul? Who did Paul get, or whenever he was Saul, get permission from to go arrest and even kill Christians? These same people. The same people that gave Paul permission to persecute the way is now giving permission to these Jewish 40 men to do the same thing to Paul. A bit of an ironic moment, I think. Also, I find this quite ironic as well. These are supposed to be the leading men of God. These were the same men that whenever Paul accidentally says something against the high priest, they strike him in the face because he was violating the laws of God by speaking against God's anointed. And yet, these are the very men where they're like, yeah, we're okay if you kill him. We're okay if you deceive and lie and end up killing him. That's okay. Why? Because it protects our honor and our prestige. It protects our power. We have no problem throwing out all of the book, even all the Ten Commandments, if it means getting what we want. These are the men of God that are charged with keeping the law of God in the land, that are now throwing out the entire book just so that they can protect their own positions of power. And obviously, well, I shouldn't say obviously, but the third thing I find ironic is this also sounds an awful lot like Jesus. Sounds an awful lot like Jesus, where the people, to keep their honor and power, their positions of prestige, to regain their honor because they have been shamed by Jesus, are even willing to kill him, to throw out the book, to even have illegal proceedings, to even commit murder in order to get what they want. I don't have time to go on a big, long tangent of devotional moment here, but while murder probably won't be something that's on your docket, you'll also be tempted to follow by this same type of thinking in your ministries as well. We'll just fudge that a little bit. I know that slander and things are bad like that, but you know what? This guy had it coming to him. I know that the money should have gone there, but we can just put it over here. It's not a big deal. You're going to have the temptation to do the same thing. As a matter of fact, especially whenever somebody comes and they're accusing you of stuff that maybe even is true, and you'll be tempted to fight with all that you have, throwing out the entire book to get what you want. It's such an incredible... Because honestly, when it comes to being a minister, there's a level of power and responsibility that has to be held in tension. people really, they trust you when you're standing at the pulpit and whenever you're teaching and preaching to them. They trust you. And you can use that trust to destroy people, or you can use that trust to actually lead them to Jesus. And sometimes what you'll even want to do is lead them to Jesus by kind of detouring and bringing yourself into an honorific situation. Man, it's such a temptation. And in that moment, whenever you realize, I want you to understand the power and influence that you do have over people. But you also need to understand it comes with responsibility, because I do believe, James says, teachers will be held to a higher accountability. We will be judged more strictly. Because ultimately, what you do affects other people's lives. And I think the whole millstone type scenario could be attached to people that are teachers as well. For if you're leading one of these little ones astray, woe to you. Woe to you when you try to throw out the book to keep what you want or to get what you want. Man, there's some churches that I'm helping deal with right now where, I mean, literally, the minister is allowing a petition to go around the community, not even the church, the community, to keep his job. Because the elders have said, we are tired of you undercutting the leadership from the pulpit. We will give a proclamation of what the church is going to do, and from the pulpit you'll undercut us, and you've done it for so many years that we're saying it's time for a transition. And they're trying to do it benevolently, and what he's doing instead, what the minister's doing instead, is fighting for his position by trying to rally his troops and cause all kinds of disunity in order to fight for himself. And I'm sorry, but God doesn't handle disunity in his church very well. You want to fight for something, you want to be something, you want to go down in the book for knowing to fighting for the heart of God, fight for unity in the church. Unity is something God deeply cherishes. Matter of fact, it's one of the very, when Jesus in John 17, one of his very last things he prays is, God, I pray they will be unified so that the world may know who I am. He prays for unity. It's one of the things I find both ironic and frustrating and beautiful all at the same time about our movement. We're a movement that was founded on bringing unity. And our movement now is split into four different sections. And we, you know, throw bombs by saying snide remarks about Baptists or Lutherans or... Really? That's, you know, or Catholics. Good grief. How many bombs can we throw at Catholics in a day? That's a unity movement. Come on, we can do better than that. Do we really need to be throwing everybody under the bus that doesn't agree with us? That's how we achieve unity? No, it hasn't worked in our movement, and it won't work in your churches. You don't throw bombs at people that you don't agree with. You sit down at meals with them, and you get to know them. And you share your heart, and you hear their heart. And maybe within that interaction, that personal interaction, unity may be fostered. It may not be. You may have to pull apart, you may have to ultimately end in a Paul and Barnabas situation. Nevertheless, if you fight for yourself more than you fight for the church, you'll have some bad company. Does that make sense? You'll be doing exactly what the Jewish elite are doing right now to Paul, and what they did to Jesus, and what they did to the church. So don't do that. Story of the day, lesson of the day. All right, verse 16. But when the son of Paul's sister heard of this plot, who is the son of Paul's sister? Who would that be to Paul? His nephew. When Paul's nephew heard of this plot, he went into the barracks and told Paul. Now, where did his family come from? Where did his family come from? Do they follow Paul here for the festival? Maybe. More than likely, though, why is a family member of Paul here? They live there. Acts chapter 22, verse 2. Paul says in a speech, I am a Jew born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city. When Paul was a young boy, his entire family moves to Jerusalem. For what reasons, we don't know exactly, but it may have had something to do with putting Paul in close proximity to rabbis that could train him, like Gamaliel, hello, that could train him in the ways of the law. His entire family moves there. More than likely, his sister would have been there as well, because she would have gone with them. And she now has her family still living in Jerusalem. And one of Paul's nephews hears of the plot, and he goes to the barracks to try and talk to Paul, tell Paul what is happening. Then Paul called one of the centurions, verse 17, and said, take this young man to the commander. Notice Paul's language here. First of all, what does he say? What does he not say, I guess I should say? What does he not say? Yeah, he doesn't say, take my nephew. He says, take this young man. Now, I could be reading more into that, but what happens here next, I think there's a reason why Paul is doing this, why he's being a little bit discreet himself. Take this young man to the commander. He has something to tell him. What does he not tell him? What does he not say to the centurion? What he has to tell them. Why? Why is Paul being so sly? Yeah. Yeah, because ultimately this plot is so serious and the zeal for it is so intense. They're not going to eat, and they've even called curses down on themselves until this happens. Paul realizes everyone should be suspected. This is something we got to keep as close as we possibly can. At this point, it's not just Paul that's in danger, but his very nephew is, because he has information. Well, because in Paul's mind, it could have been something like this. What if the centurion even was not even just in cahoots with the people? What if the centurion was like, we could be having this situation in which people could maybe even be attacking the Roman centurions when we were taking Paul somewhere? And what if he decided to protect his own skin or the skin of his brother, his other soldiers? He said, you know what? Let's dispose of the nephew of Paul and let's just let them do to Paul what they're going to do. Why should we lay our lives down for this guy? It's a random coup. It couldn't have been prevented, and the Jews did it to themselves. Ultimately, Paul says, I have one ally and one ally only, and it's the guy that saved me three times already. Claudius Lysias, the commander. So he says, take this young fella and let him go to the commander and tell him some interesting news. Centurion doesn't know, but he takes him to the commander. The centurion said, Paul, the prisoner, sent for me and asked me to bring this young man to you because he has something to tell you. The commander took the young man by the hand, drew him aside, and asked, what is it you want to tell me? Actually, it's kind of ironic. The word for young man really puts this nephew anywhere from 20 to 40 years old. I mean, young is a little bit of a relative term. Anyway, verse 20, he said, the Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul before the Sanhedrin tomorrow on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about him. Don't give in to them, because more than 40 of them are awaiting in ambush for him. They have taken an oath not to eat or drink until they have killed him. They are ready now, waiting for your consent to the request. The commander dismissed the young man and cautioned him. Notice what he cautions him. Don't tell anyone that you have reported this to me. See, the commander realizes the same thing Paul realized. This is a big deal. These people will stop at nothing to get what they want. They will throw out the entire book. They will even threaten the Roman Empire in order to kill Paul. That's how zealous they are about this. They would even be willing, hear this, they would even be willing to do something as ludicrous as maybe strapping a bomb on themselves and blowing people up in order to get what they want. To perpetuate, to protect their religious purity. Is this making sense? The zeal has not changed, even today. It's just that we've talked about that. We're not as zealous as what I think we should be, although I don't think we should be doing bombs. You hear me on that. We should just be strapping crosses to our backs a little bit more often than what we do. They've taken an oath not to kill. The commander says, don't tell anyone. Why? Because we're all in danger. Paul's in danger, you're in danger, and now I'm in danger. Then he called two of his centurions and ordered them, get ready at a detachment of 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at 9 tonight. Provide mounts for Paul so that he may be taken safely to Governor Felix. This is a brilliant political strategy. Claudius Lysias realizes he's in over his head. He's already committed some major atrocities in dealing with Paul the prisoner. We've talked about the Lex Porcia and the almost Lex Valeria. The Lex Porcia is what law? Which says you can't do what to a Roman citizen? Bind them. Lex Valeria is what law that you can't do a Roman citizen? Beat them. He's already committed the first one and barely didn't commit the second one. So, those two things in place, Claudius Lysias realizes I'm in over my head, because not only am I implicated in this, but now the Jews have realized that they're not going to, or I have realized the Jews will stop at nothing. They're going to kill him. And if he dies under my hegemony, under my power, I'm the one that's going to be held accountable to that. Especially if it causes some sort of riot. Claudius Lysias says, I've got to do something. And his answer is, let's pass the buck. let's get rid of Paul. Let's move him on and make it Felix's problem. Because ultimately what he does is this, in this letter in a minute here, he's going to feign, I don't know what to do. I need to appeal to your intelligence. You're so much more brilliant than me. In reality, he's going, this is such a sticky political situation. I don't want to be held accountable. It's your problem now. Because he doesn't want to mess with this. So what does he do? He gets 470 soldiers to take Paul and take him to Caesarea, which is 58 miles away from Jerusalem. 470. Paul is in the middle. He's got 200 swordsmen around him. Then around the swordsmen, you have 70 horsemen. And around those, you have 200 more spearmen, which would have been anywhere from archery to bows to spears, things of that nature. And that's going to be their defense for one man. And he's going to be on a mount, so he's held in a place where he's not going to be the one who needs to walk. They are going to take him themselves, surrounded, all the way to Caesarea. But when do they do it? What's that? At night. The Roman soldiers were in such good condition that it didn't matter whether it was day or night. It didn't matter how far they needed to go. They were like machines. And at 9 o'clock at the night, they're going to start a trek of 58 miles that will take 2 days. You can average at the highest of speeds, you can average probably around 20 to 26 miles a day. So it's going to take them 2 days or so in order to get to Caesarea. So they're going to start at 9 o'clock at night. Why? Because that'll give them about a 12-hour head start. About a 12-hour head start from the people that will be pursuing them, the 40 or so that want to take on 470. Provide mounts, da-da-da-da. He wrote, verse 25, he wrote a letter as follows, Claudius Lysias, to His Excellency, Governor Felix, greetings. That is a typical beginning of an ancient letter. We've talked about this in Acts 15, right? What are the three key elements of an ancient letter at the very beginning? Who is writing it? To whom it is being written? And greetings. That's exactly what you have here. Claudius Lysias, which is the name of the Roman commander we've been dealing with for the past three chapters. The Greek says, Most Excellent Governor Felix. Oh, we've heard that before too, haven't we? It's not in Acts though. Where is it? Most Excellent... Theophilus. Luke chapter 1 verse 3. Most Excellent Theophilus. Same beginning. To Most Excellent Governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and they were about to kill him. But I came with my troops and rescued him. For I had learned that he is a Roman citizen. I wanted to know why they were accusing him, so I brought him to their Sanhedrin. I found that the accusation had to do with questions about their law, but there was no charge against him that deserved death or imprisonment. When I was informed of a plot to be carried out against the man, I sent him to you at once. I also ordered his accusers to present to you their case against him. Who's the hero? Claudius Lysias. In those five verses, there are 9 first-person pronouns. I did this. And what does he conveniently leave out, though? I had this Roman citizen in chains. I almost beat him. It wasn't like this is the golden boy here. But you don't advance politically in their age or in our age by not twisting some of the facts in order to make yourself look good. You just don't. That's the way you do it. You kind of slant things in order to make yourself look way better than what you are just by leaving out some details. Because technically what he said wasn't exactly inaccurate, was it? Really wasn't, technically. Technically, he is the one that came in and stopped them from beating and killing him. Technically, he did find out he's a Roman citizen and then changed the course of where he was headed. Technically, he was let in on their plot, and technically, he is the one that is now sending them. But if you know the whole story, that's not exactly right. A little shady, but he's a good politician. So the soldiers, verse 31, carrying out their orders, took Paul with them during the night and brought him as far as Antipatris. The next day they let the cavalry go on with him while they returned to the barracks. Now notice what they did. They had 470 people going with him. They take him about 26 to 28 miles away. They stop and say, now just the cavalry take you with him, and the 400 are going to go back. Why? Because they know very well that whenever the Jews hear this, there could be a significant problem in Jerusalem. At the time of the Passover, there'd be about 1,000 Roman soldiers inside the city in order to keep peace. He has sent 470 to Caesarea. Now, when they get halfway, he brings 400 back, so there's about 930 to make sure that there's no riot in Jerusalem. Does this make sense? Very smart tactic. He gives them about a 12 to 15 hour head start. They get going. Once they get halfway there, he says, now the cavalry, you can just take you the rest of the way. And it'll actually speed up how fast they can go. Okay, everybody follow me? There was a question? Yeah. Possibly. I mean, it's very possible that Paul may even have kept the letter with him at all times in order to make sure that, that after the trial of Festus or Felix, that he was still being able to show, hey, I'm innocent. It's possible that Luke talked to one of the soldiers that held it. There's a numerous amount of ways in which you would have access to that information. One of the things you have to remember, consistently you have to remember when you're going through anything New Testament, is the amazing memory that the people would have had at that day and age. Whenever you're in a society that is 90% illiterate, you follow me? Actually, that's overstated. About 60 to 70% illiterate. Memory is going to be what you actually function on in order to communicate most of your information. And whenever you have, you know, 8-year-old boys that are Jews and they're, you know, expected to memorize the first 5 books of the Old Testament by the time that they're 8, you're going to realize that memory is something that actually is such a deep part of their society that memory is memorizing something like that, and that they could sneeze that out. I mean, that's not hard at all. For us, memory is just not something we really function off. It's one of the blessed curses of technology. We actually don't even need to really exercise our minds of memory because we have things that remember stuff for us. So memory is not a high priority for us. Therefore, we don't memorize very much. And our memories are not as robust as what they could be. But theirs would have been. It was a deep part of their culture. So even if someone even heard the letter once, they may have been able to even memorize basically what it said. Word for word, maybe, maybe not. Bottom line was, that's the message. Does that make sense? And basically all that does is sum up what Luke's already written anyway. I mean, it's not like he had to come up with brand new information. It was the information he's already written in chapter 23. Well, 21 through 23. All right, moving on. When the cavalry arrived in Caesarea, what's significant about... Well, we'll get there in a minute. They delivered the letter to the governor and handed Paul over to him. The governor read the letter and asked what province he was from. Learning that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will hear your case when your accusers get here. Why does he ask what province he's from? Yeah, to see if it's his jurisdiction. Because if it's not Felix's problem, he'll probably just pass the buck on to the guys whose problem it is. And he's probably also protecting himself because he doesn't want to rule outside somebody else's jurisdiction because that could start a kind of a latent political war between the other person and him. So yes, what province are you from? He says, oh, I'm from the province that you're ruling. He says, darn. Then we will wait and hear your case when your accusers arrive. Then he ordered that Paul be kept under guard in Herod's palace. That is very significant detail. Because the fact that he puts him in Herod's palace indicates that he was treating Paul like a political prisoner. You hearing that? He is saying, this is a political prisoner. It's one of the things that drives me crazy whenever people will argue with me till they're blue in the face that Jesus and the New Testament, you know, the Gospels as a whole or all of the church was not political. Yeah, they were. Religion and politics were so interwoven in the ancient world that you could not distinguish one from the other. Just because in our culture and society it makes sense to separate church and state doesn't mean that that's the way it's been really anywhere in the history of the world. Religion and politics have always been interwoven. Even in the UK today, religion and politics are interwoven. The Queen of England is also one of the highest ranking officials in the Church of England. Religion and politics are interwoven. That's why Sharia law in places like the Middle East, makes perfect sense to them because you don't separate religion and politics. Even though we do, the rest of the world throughout history has not. And the Roman world especially not. I mean, the emperor was considered the representative of the gods. The imperial cult, you worship the emperor as a god. Religion and politics were always interwoven. Therefore, because you have the Jewish elite that are upset with Paul over religious issues, it still is a political issue. And therefore, Paul is considered a political prisoner. And that's the way Felix treats him, by the way he imprisons him. Chapter 24, verse 1. Man, we're cruising. Good, because we need to make up a day. 5 days later, the high priest Ananias went down to Caesarea with some of the elders and a lawyer named Tertullus. Bummer. And they brought their charges against Paul before the governor. Now notice who they send. They don't just send the 40 men that have kept the oath. They don't even send the original accusers of Paul, the people from the province of Asia. They send the cream of the crop. They send the high priest. They send a high-ranking lawyer. Why would they send a lawyer? Because when they're in Felix's jurisdiction, they can't function the same way they do in their own Sanhedrin courtrooms. You have to function on Roman terms. They need someone that's well-versed in the Roman way of doing law in order for them to be successful before Felix. So Tertullus comes along, and in verse 2, when Paul was called in, Tertullus presented his case before Felix. Oh, his opening just makes me want to gag. We've enjoyed a long period of peace under you, and your foresight has brought about reforms in this nation. Everywhere and in every way, most excellent Felix, third time that's been used, we acknowledge this with profound gratitude. What is he doing? What? Buttering up the judge. That's what he's doing. He's a smart lawyer. One of the things you do is you lie to the judge and tell him how good he is, even when he was bad. Felix was not a good governor. He was a terrible governor. As a matter of fact, at this point, Felix had already been called into the emperor for being overly abusive to the people in his region. Already. He'll eventually be deposed because of his abuse. He's a mean guy. Matter of fact, he wasn't even really well liked by the Romans either. Why? Because Felix grew up as a slave. And now he has arisen to this prominence of even being a governor over in a region. Tacitus even says, he held the power of a tyrant with the disposition of a slave. It's kind of a slight, because they honestly said, because you're a slave, you shouldn't have ever have risen to this level of prominence. But even though you're there, you never escape who you truly are. You're a slave, even if you do have the power of a tyrant. This guy is evil. And Tertullus says, regardless, I want to win the case. Oh, we've enjoyed such great peace. You're so wonderful. We wouldn't want anybody else but you. Liar. Verse 4, but in order not to weary you further, I would request that you be kind enough just to hear us briefly. In other words, he's like, this is an open, shut case. You'll see it. You're so smart. You'll see it in just a minute. Whenever I present it for you, it's pretty easy which way you need to rule. We have found this man to be a troublemaker. Stop. There will be four accusations against Paul right here. Four. And the first two together may be the worst. The first one, the word troublemaker, is literally the Greek word for pestilence or a plague. He's a cancer, a disease that is spreading all throughout the world. Matter of fact, the word that he will use for world here in a minute is oikumene. It is not the word cosmos, meaning just the entire world. The word oikumene is a specific political term, which means the Roman Empire. He is a cancer, a disease in the empire. The second accusation comes right after that. He's a troublemaker, a plague, a disease. Stirring up riots among the Jews all over the oikumene. Stirring up riots, that is a major accusation for the Roman Empire. Why? Yes, the Pax Romana. Rome believed that they were sanctioned by the gods to give to the world the only thing that gods could give, and that is peace. Humans could not accomplish peace in the Roman religion. Only gods could. But the fact that Rome was accomplishing peace across the whole land was evidence that they were God's agents, the agents of the gods. Therefore, whenever peace was not found, it was actually attacking the very identity of Rome. So Rome says, we will keep peace, and we'll do it by beating you into submission. Tacitus even says that the Roman peace, the Pax Romana, is to be feared more than anything. Because the Roman peace, matter of fact, there's in Tacitus Agricolae, an enemy leader named Calgicus says, they destroy our lands and call it peace. They rape our lands and they call it plunder, or they call it prosperity. He says, they torture us and hold us in fear, and they call it pox. He says that what they call peace, we call terrorism. Nevertheless, peace is what was kept. And if you violated peace, Rome would come at you with an iron fist and it would be brutal. It's one of the reasons why Jesus was crucified. Hello. because he was threatening the peace of Rome. And Rome says, well, we'll hang you on a tree. Just let everybody know what happens whenever you mess with the Pax Romana. He's stirring up riots among the Jews all over the world. Here's the problem. It's kind of true, isn't it? Do we need to go back through all the city? Well, I have a list here. That's always convenient. It's called preparation. Number one, Pisidian Antioch, Iconium, Lystra, Thessalonica, Ephesus, and Jerusalem are the ones that we have just in Acts, of places where he did start a riot because of what he was teaching. Technically, it wasn't him starting it. The Jews were following around and stirring him up. But the riots could all be attached to Paul all over the world. Here comes the third accusation. He is a ringleader of the Nazarene sect. That right there is, there is a rule, a law in Rome where if you were conquered, you could keep the religions that you had in place. But no new religion could be created. You could not create a new religion. You could only keep the religions you already had. And what he is saying here is that Paul has created a new religion. He's actually violated one of your laws. And it is because he's created that new religion that has led to the riots, which has led to why I call him a troublemaker to begin with. Fourth accusation. And he even tried to desecrate the temple. He said, and then he looks at our religion with his new religion, and he even tries to destroy our religion. Our religion is legal. His is illegal. And that's one of the reasons why all these riots are happening. And that's the reason why I look at him and say he is a plague. He is a disease. He needs to be eradicated. So we seized him. We did you a favor, is what Tertullus says. We were trying to help you keep the peace. We seized him. We arrested him. By examining him yourself, you will be able to learn the truth about all these charges we are bringing against him. In other words, he says, this is what our charges are, but you know what? Whenever you ask him questions, you'll see how clear this is. Because you're smart, Felix. You're so nice and smart and wonderful. So use your intelligence and give me what I want. Verse 9, the Jews joined in the accusation, asserting that these things were true. Yep, he's right. Tertullus is right. Even the high priest says so. When the governor motioned for him to speak, Paul replied, I know that for a number of years you have been a judge over this nation, so I gladly make my defense. I love Paul's beginning because he does give him honor, but he doesn't go over the top. He says, I know for many years you've actually done a pretty good job, so I'm glad to be able to give you a defense because you're the ruler. So here we go. He doesn't go into the line of, oh, you're amazing, you're so wonderful, I've never seen anyone like you. He's going to tell the truth, but he's going to give him honor while he doesn't. You can easily verify that no more than 12 days ago I went up to Jerusalem to worship. My accusers did not find me arguing with anyone at the temple or stirring up a crowd in the synagogues or anywhere else in the city. He says, let me deal with the first two problems. I'm not a troublemaker. I went to worship their God in the temple. I wasn't arguing. They started it. I was just there worshiping. I'm not starting a riot. They started the riot. He's dealing with each of their accusations. My accusers did not find me arguing with anyone at the temple or stirring up a crowd in the synagogues or anywhere else in the city. And they cannot prove to you the charges they are now making against me. However, I do admit that I worship the God of our fathers as a follower of the way, which they call a sect. What is he saying? This isn't a new religion. It's actually the same one that they belong to. It's just that they haven't seen how their religion has continued past them. There's a new manifestation, a new capitulation of Judaism in Jesus. I'm not starting a new religion. They call it a sect. I call it Judaism. Found in Jesus. See what he's saying? That's one of the things you got to understand. The church doesn't replace Israel as Israel. The church is Israel, that Israel always was. We are God's people. We didn't start something new. We didn't replace anything. We are continuing the line that God began in the Old Testament into the new through Jesus. Is this making sense? It's not been a stop and relaunch. It's one continuous line that has always been going, that started with Abraham, has now come to fruition in the church. There's no break. It's one continuous line of promise after promise after promise. The only thing that is new is the covenant that now defines the community in a way that is under Jesus. Nevertheless, it does not mean we have broken from the past. This is what's behind Jesus' discussion in Matthew chapter 5, verses 17 and following, whenever he says, I've not come to abolish the law. I've come to fulfill it. I'm not scrapping this. I'm saying that whenever you trace this, it actually leads to me and everything that comes after me. I'm continuing. I'm not breaking. I'm not starting anything new. And that's what Paul's saying here. Does that make sense? There's actually a lot more theology behind that that could cause some people some get pretty upset, but let's just leave it at that for now. I believe everything that agrees with the law and that is written in the prophets. He says, so if my religion's illegal, then theirs is too. And I have the same hope in God as these men, that there will be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. Now he's getting to the real issue, something they conveniently left out, by the way, the whole resurrection issue. So I strive always to keep my conscience clear before God and man. After an absence of several years, I came to Jerusalem to bring my people gifts for the poor and to present offerings. You want to know why I was in Jerusalem? It wasn't to start a riot. It was to feed the poor. So if I'm guilty of being benevolent, then yes, throw me in jail. But I'm not guilty of starting a riot. I was ceremonially clean when they found me in the temple courts doing this. There was no crowd with me, nor was I involved in any disturbance. But there are some Jews from the province of Asia who ought to be here before you to bring charges if they have anything against me. What is he saying there? These aren't even the ones that initially accused me. And the people that really did accuse me aren't even here. So maybe it's because I'm not guilty of anything. You really want to talk to people that first accused me? Go find the Jews from the province of Asia, from Ephesus. They're the ones that caused this problem, and they're not even here. Or these who are here should state what crime they found in me when I stood before the Sanhedrin. Ooh, what crime was he convicted of before the Sanhedrin? Oh, think. This was only like a chapter ago. What? Was there a verdict in the Sanhedrin? How did the Sanhedrin situation end? By pronouncement of his guilt? By a fight between them. He says, actually, why don't we talk about the way I was judged at the Sanhedrin? Oh, we don't want to talk about that. Why? Because they were the ones fighting, and what over what issue? And he says, this is the issue, and that's what he brings up. Unless it is this one thing I shouted as I stood in their presence. It is concerning the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial before you today. What is Paul doing? He's saying, Felix, this is a religious issue. Why are they upset with me? They're simply because we disagree theologically, not because I'm doing anything politically wrong for you. They disagree with my theology about the resurrection. And what would Felix normally do if he was a good Roman ruler? Same thing Gallio did, which was what? What's that? Gallio looks at him and he says, get this out of my court. This is a disagreement amongst your religion. Says that anything to do with Roman politics. He's not a threat to us. He's a threat to you and your position of power. You deal with it in a way that Rome would sanction it and say it's okay. Paul's saying the reason why they're upset with me is not because I'm causing riots or I'm a plague. It's not because I've desecrated or almost desecrated the temple or started a new religion. It's because they don't believe in the resurrection. That's always been the issue. And we'll pick up verse 22 tomorrow. Love you guys. See you in the morning.